where he studied cosmic rays experimentally by flying balloon instruments. He then went to Caltech as a senior research fellow, and that's where I met John. He and I worked together on observations of accreting X-ray pulsars, highly magnetic neutron stars, a project that John initiated while a postdoc there, and something that turned out to be quite fruitful. The only problem for me was that after working with him for about a year, he arrived at my office to announce that in 2 weeks he was leaving. And where he was going was the astronaut corps, and when you're asked to show up, you go. So John, since then, has participated in 4 space shuttle missions, over 45 days in space. He's done 5 spacewalks, totaling over 37 hours. He's also led a team of scientists tasked with defining and producing crew displays for the International Space Station. And most importantly, he succeeded in calling car talk while in orbit. While the rest of us continue to do science, as I like to say, under the full force of gravity, John decided it was best done in free fall. And his first mission was in 1995, where he participated in the flight of the Astro Observatory, an ultraviolet telescope. This was a 16-day mission during which they observed with the ultraviolet telescope many astronomical objects. In 1997, John flew again on the shuttle to ferry supplies to the Mir space station. In 1999, John made his first trip to the Hubble Space Telescope. That was an 8-day mission where he and the crew successfully installed new gyroscopes and scientific instruments. And on that mission, he did his first 2 spacewalks. And then in most recently, in March of this year, 2002, John was the payload commander for the flight to the Hubble Space Telescope, where he again did spacewalks, and that's what he's going to tell us about today. So let's welcome John.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Lars. It's really a pleasure to be here, and from the town hall meeting, one thing became very clear, and it gave me a chance to focus a little bit about partly how I got to being here in front of you to speak, and why I might be a good role model. And it really has to do with the excitement of science. And I heard Lawrence's talk this morning, and it still makes me very excited. And I'll say a few remarks about that and the role of Hubble in a few minutes. But it really does come down, I think, for me, to a few pivotal teachers. And the first was in the 3rd grade. And so I'll tell you that story real quick. And then there were a couple in high school that were very important to me. But in the 3rd grade, even prior to that, I did decide I wanted to be an astronaut at about 6 or 7. And it was, I think, just serendipity that I grew up on the south side of Chicago. When I was 6 or 7 years old, we got our first television. And it was the same time that the Gemini astronauts were going up. So on that television, I have indelible images in my brain of rockets going up with people on board. And the excitement surrounding humans going to the moon. And at that time, I decided I wanted to go to the moon as well, which I still would like to do. And I'm working on that. That's sort of a background project, unfunded research at the moment. But it was in the 3rd grade that I had to do my first biography. And Mrs. Loeb was my 3rd grade teacher, public school, south side of Chicago. And she just started in the first row and started naming people for the students for us to write biographies about. And she said George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Babe Ruth, Ron Santo, who's Chicago. Anyway, she got to me and she said Enrico Fermi, and my little heart sank. I mean, I couldn't have been more disappointed. I had absolutely no clue who Enrico Fermi was, and without missing a beat, she just continued down the row with other famous people. And I truly think that it was a random assignment. And I have since seen her again, and she has no recollection of this. But it was truly a random assignment. And it's one of those quirky things in nature that occasionally these, the planets align and such. And so also growing up on the south side of Chicago, that was Fermi's playground. I got to learn about his life and read some of the books, great giants of science for 3rd graders. Enrico Fermi, 2 or 3 pages. But it turns out my neighbor, a chemist, was somebody who had worked with Fermi. So I took my little notebook and spent an hour with him, and he told me all sorts of wonderful stories, about climbing in the Dolomites and talking about science. And it was that, gave me the idea that science was something that was a lot of fun. And that basically carried through my whole life. And in high school, there's no question I was one of the nerds. And I liked to do science, and you know, after school I would go in and fix the chemistry teacher's equipment that had broken. I liked to fix things, and spent a lot of time, you know, with a small group of friends that were the nerds. I was not a very popular kid in high school. I wasn't football team or anything like that. And but nevertheless, there were two teachers, both of them AP teachers, one in calculus and one in chemistry, that were definitely role models for me as far as, you know, trying to inspire me to ask questions and to do good science at the high school level. So what you do is extremely important, and you know, I'm sure you already know this, but you know, the likelihood is you only touch a few students in a way that allows them to go on to be cosmologists. And you know, you only hope that they don't end up being particle physicists, but maybe maybe that eventually they will learn the importance of the bigger picture. And but I think, you know, I think it's all very exciting. And so hopefully what you can bring away from my talk, but more so from the earlier talks, is how really exciting and fun science is at the level that we're at, and what an extraordinary time we live in, that we're learning what we're learning and how we are learning it, and take that to your students. And the, you know, the anecdotal stories and being able to teach your curriculum, but then, you know, step back and say, you know, well, this, as I remember, my PSSC physics, and you're doing wave experiments in a tank, and then you say, and you know, before the radiation and matter decoupled, you know, there were waves in the universe, and we can see those today, or you know, however you want to phrase that. I'm gonna talk to you mostly today about the Hubble Space Telescope mission that I went on in March. And I kind of want to do it like this is, you know, you've been engaging your brains in great detail for hours and hours, and I'd like, I don't really want to say entertain you, but I want you to relax and just sort of enjoy the experience of me describing my little travels. I kind of think of as, in a sense, space adventure. What I did was to enable great science. We didn't really do great science on this mission. We were busy enough, you know, just trying to survive and to upgrade the telescope. But I, you know, I also want to hopefully to stimulate, you know, your ideas about people doing science and people engaged in the scientific enterprise. And so what I'm going to do is show some slides, a short movie. It's really, you know, it's a real home movie of a space mission. And then finish up with showing you some results from the new cameras that we put up on the Hubble Space Telescope. So I really do want to just start with sort of that romance of science. Lars gave you a little bit of the background, but the top two pictures are pictures of me as a graduate student at the University of Chicago. I met Dan there while I was at graduate school, and I'm working on a balloon payload. And this was a very high-energy cosmic ray payload. I was measuring the energy spectrum of iron at very high energies. The iron nuclei are zipping through the galaxy at nearly the speed of light, and in fact, Enrico Fermi was the one who sort of figured out the mechanism for how these things get accelerated that fast. Of course, indirectly, I want to be accelerated that fast all at once, though. So, you know, I can zip around. That's not going to happen. But building experiments and having the responsibility for being at that cutting edge of having to do science and having the pressure to get an experiment built and ready for a target where it was going to be launched on a high-altitude balloon, and then standing there while the material is unfolding and making, you know, neat noises and having the sun rising and just, you know, realizing that all of that emotional and intellectual energy and physical energy that you've put into this experiment is about to leave planet Earth in the balloon's case to go near the edge of the atmosphere, you know, is all tied up in that very moment. And then the balloon disappears and you go and sit in a computer for 40 hours watching your data come down, and then years of analyzing it to try and understand the result. But that's a tremendous experience for students to have as they go on to college and graduate school, and something that really crafts, you know, the kind of characters that go on to go 2,000 feet below their surface to look at look for WIMPs. For me, it gave me the training that I needed to go and fix the Hubble Space Telescope. I really think of my career as starting, you know, in that third grade, but as an experimental physicist, learning all the techniques and working under time pressures and having to succeed, that enabled me to go up and be successful on the Hubble Space Telescope. The fighter pilots in the astronaut corps sort of debate that. They say, well, anybody can learn to operate an experiment. That's just not true. You know, we turn it around and say, well, we could fly the space shuttle. And they go, oh no, it takes years of training and flight and test pilot school, and you have to learn all those subtle details, and it's exactly the same in experimental physics. You can't train somebody to do experimental physics from a CD-ROM course or, you know, on the web, you know, you have to make a lot of mistakes, you have to learn a lot of things, and you have to build on that experience, and it takes many years to be able to do the hard experiments. And so that's something that, you know, I really credit science and my experimental background to enabling me to do some of the things we did. It is an incredibly remarkable time to be here at the KITP and having the discussions that we've had today. Because 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the discussions would have been very different. And, you know, I sort of think back about 100 years. 100 years ago, nobody had ever flown in a powered airplane before. And, you know, that was sort of my grandfather's time. And in my father's time, when he was born, that was right about the time that we figured out that, in fact, we live in a galaxy and there are a lot of other galaxies. And prior to that, and it wasn't that long ago, it just wasn't known. I mean, there were fuzzy blobs and pieces of glass. And, you know, there were a lot of active debates as we debate string theory and membrane theory and all these things. They were debating, you know, what are these fuzzy blobs? And it was very heated. And, you know, so it's just very exciting to think that a few miles from here at the 100-inch telescope, you know, a lot of these observations were made, and that's the director there, Carnegie, and then Edwin Powell Hubble, namesake for the Hubble Space Telescope, and Einstein, and all the things that went on then, and the sudden discovery that we live in a universe filled with galaxies, and the explosion of cosmology, and just a small detail, the eyepiece that Einstein is looking through on that 100-inch telescope, I had the privilege of taking up to space with me on to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's not up there now. I brought it back. And another sort of interesting event that drives us being here today, and certainly me going into space, was this. Okay. Who does not recognize that sound? Well, fortunately, it's only 10 seconds. So yesterday was the 45th anniversary of Sputnik launching. And, you know, I'm very thankful that the Russians did that because it drove our space program that enabled me in this time to be able to go to space. And so I reflect back to that powered flight thing. 100 years ago, you know, nobody had flown in a powered airplane, and the Wright brothers did that. 45 years ago, nobody had launched anything into Earth orbit. Or 45 years in a day, and the Russians did that driving the space program. And so just, you know, 30 years ago was the very beginning of the space program, and now an astronomer gets to go up on the space shuttle and do astronomy, as I did on my first mission, and enable astronomy, as I did on the Hubble Space Telescope mission. So it's just an incredible time for us to be involved in all of this. And science is always exciting, but I think it's particularly exciting now. And this used to be, prior to my first Hubble mission, my favorite Hubble picture. And just because it is so inspiring. Let's see. I've got one here. And as we heard this morning, this is a picture of a region that Bob Williams, then director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, wanted to take a picture in a region of the sky a little smaller than your pinky held at arm's length that in the sky surveys was basically devoid of anything interesting. And that's a star in our own galaxy. Everything else is another galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars, as you've heard. And I just thought, you know, this was just incredible when this picture came out. I mean, just totally inspiring. And if you could teach this in a classroom, you'd get a lot of mileage. But it gets even better, as you've heard. And So I want to show you, you know, what has enabled that, because it's really a people story. You know, it's not a galaxy story, it's a people story. And so here's the people that I went up with on this last mission in March. We were up for 10 days. This is Scott Altman. He's our commander. He's a Navy pilot. This is his third flight. And you've seen him probably. How many people have seen the movie Top Gun? Okay, a bunch of people. And if you think Tom Cruise was flying any of those airplanes, then you know you're severely misled. Scott Altman was one of the four pilots who flew those airplanes, and the movie company paid the Navy a certain amount to operate the aircraft carrier, a certain amount to fly the airplanes, and in fact they even paid the pilots to fly those scenes. Now I have absolutely no idea how much Tom Cruise made, but as an astronomer, I can make pretty good order of magnitude estimate. Scott Altman made $24 a day, and I know Tom made a lot more. Our pilot on the mission was Duane Carey. He's an Air Force pilot. This was his first mission. Rick Linehan is a veterinarian on his third mission, and you may wonder, why do we have a veterinarian? He was actually my spacewalking partner, as you'll see in the film. And he was a large mammal veterinarian, mostly whales, dolphins, seals. But there's a lot of large mammals here, so he was also our crew medical officer. But doing surgery on animals is the same kind of critical skill as doing surgery on a $6 billion telescope. So he was a good asset. Mike Massimino is a mechanical engineer, his first flight. Nancy Curry is an Army helicopter pilot on her fourth flight. She was our flight engineer and also the robotic arm primary operator. You know who that is. And Jim Newman is an optical physicist on his fourth flight. He had done work at Rice University. Now, as the payload commander on this mission, I was responsible for the care and feeding of Hubble and design of all the spacewalks and overall integration for the mission. But I also got to have the privilege of helping with the crew photo. And so I picked this particular ESO galaxy because I thought it was a nice picture and because I could always hide some information in that picture that I waited to tell the crew until after it was already produced. And of course, this is a tidally disrupted warped galaxy. Not that that's necessarily any comment about the crew at all, but it's sort of a fun thing to know. So with that, I'd like to roll the video and then I'll press on with the slides. While we're doing the switch, the Hubble Space Telescope is one of the NASA Great Observatories, and that's just a catchy name for a program of four telescopes. We have the Hubble, we have the Chandra X-ray Observatory, and the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. Those are the three that we've had. Compton since re-entered and burned up, but right now we have Chandra in X-rays and Hubble in optical, ultraviolet, and infrared. And anytime you open a new window, you do discover things, and we have the Space Infrared Observatory. I think that's at high speed. Mike's usually that fast, but the rest of us. Okay, getting into the space shuttle, it's a little bit tight, and you can imagine getting into your minivan if it were pointing up at the sky. It'd be a little more challenging. Scott's a big guy, so it's even more challenging for him. On the mid-deck, it's a little bit easier. Keep in mind that at this point, we're sitting on 4.5 million pounds of explosives.
Team out of 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, main engine start, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of Space Shuttle Program to broaden our view of the universe through the Hubble Space Telescope.
The Space Shuttle, unlike the Saturn V's, really leaps off the pad. This is slow motion. Here's the view from inside. Those seats are very stiff. This is a very violent event. This is a scary one.
Roger roll, Columbia.
You have almost 8 million pounds of thrust leaving the pad, so really, it accelerates to over 100 miles an hour before it even clears the tower that's 300 feet tall. We went through a cloud deck, which was really interesting. I'd never seen that before, looking in the forward windows and seeing the acceleration because I had a reference point. Usually you're just accelerating into the blackness. We ride on the solid rocket motors for 2 minutes, and then we get rid of those. And they re-enter, they're reused, they come down on parachutes, and then we ride the three main engines, which are liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. That's staging from the inside. And then it gets smooth and everybody gets comfortable, although we still have these big turbo pumps pumping cryogenic fuel at high speed in these engines. 8.5 minutes later, we're traveling about 17,500 miles an hour. The acceleration goes to zero, which is wonderful, from 3 Gs, and anything that's not tied down starts floating, including our external tank, which will re-enter and burn up over the Indian Ocean. It's very thin. We had a very ambitious program on this mission, so we started right out to get the whole cabin changed over from a rocket ship to our staging ground in space for the spacesuits. This is some amateur video I shot when... that was animation just shows how we're going to rendezvous under the space telescope and grab it with the arm. The rendezvous is almost entirely done using ground-based and onboard-based solutions that the computers come up with. We fire the jets in a digital autopilot, so we're not actually firing them ourselves. The computer does that until we get close. Once we get close, Scott Altman, our commander, takes over with the controls and starts flying the shuttle manually. And it's just very hard for computers to do that in space. Orbital mechanics, as many of you know, is not intuitive, and so it's something that's easier for people to learn than necessarily to teach a computer to do it and then test it, because you don't have a lot of opportunities to test it in space. Nancy guided the arm in. The Hubble Space Telescope weighs about 25,000 pounds. The orbiter is about 250,000 pounds. So after she grabs the telescope and puts it into the shuttle so we can work on it. We're actually bringing the two vehicles together. She trained for about a year to do that task, so she was really happy when she got it. Of course, the four of us spacewalkers were even happier because otherwise we couldn't go out and do our work. The first night, we also had to retract the solar arrays. And that was a little bit unnerving because on the first servicing mission, one of the arrays didn't retract. And Kathy Thornton had to throw it overboard, and it took about 4 years to re-enter. We have an International Space Station. I didn't mention we're up at about 350 miles. And about 200 miles is an International Space Station. I didn't want to have to throw an array over and go, look out below. So fortunately, both arrays rolled up, and it gave us a chance to go out to work on the telescope. Now, the first 3 days of the five EVAs, the first three EVAs, were to change the power system. So we changed out these old solar arrays, which were built by the European Space Agency. They are about a 15% contribution to the entire Hubble program. They get about 20 or 25% of the science, which I think is due to the large Italian contingent at the Space Telescope Science Institute. But we took those old solar arrays off and brought them back to planet Earth. Now they're being analyzed to see how much orbital debris has hit them. The reason we changed them out is they're silicon-based solar arrays. And everybody's going to use this prop today. They're made out of a material like this. And the solar radiation causes them to degrade over time. And everybody wants more power. And the telescope does too. So we put on gallium arsenide arrays, which are smaller, which are rigid arrays. Instead of unrolling, they're on these big frames. That'll reduce the jitter in the telescope even further so it can take sharper images. And they won't degrade as fast. Plus, they're providing more power, about 20% more power. So we put on new solar arrays on both sides. This should allow the Hubble Space Telescope to operate another decade if we have the funding to do it. And if the astronomical community, you know, needs the resource, which I think right now the Hubble is oversubscribed 8-to-1. For every hour that gets observed, 8 people would like to have that slot but don't get it. These solar arrays are rather valuable, but they're also too heavy. They're about 800 pounds to be tethered to it. And so that was a picture of Rick turning the array around, and that was one of his nerve-wracking moments. He didn't want to lose that solar array. We guided it into the telescope. It's held on just by a simple clamp on the side of the telescope. There aren't a lot of forces up there. Everything's in free fall, so that 800-pound array, Rick had to learn how to deal with the inertia of it, but he didn't have to hold it. He could let go in principle and go, ha-ha, and then grab it again. I'm very glad he didn't do that. These new arrays unfold like a book and then are locked into place. That's a good thing. They're very rigid, but if we ever have to bring the Hubble back, we'll have to throw those overboard. So this is the new look of the Hubble Space Telescope. I'll show you a picture of what it used to look like, the robotic arm. We record everything on digital tape now, so our pilot was sort of the Cecil B. DeMille on board and responsible for these home movies. We'll see that when we get to the landing phase as well. The way the Hubble orients itself in space, it doesn't have any little gas thrusters. It's all has to be something that's reusable. So we have very large gyroscopes. We have four of them. And these gyroscopes store momentum, and you spin them up or slow them down in concert with the other gyroscopes, and you can slowly move the telescope to point at different places in the sky. Once you get there, the Hubble can stay extremely still. And that's one of the wonderful things about Hubble, is it can point at one spot in the sky for long periods of time, much longer than you can on Earth, because of course on Earth you have to move the telescope and eventually you hit the horizon and the sun comes up. But with Hubble you can look at things for long periods of time, very deep. The third spacewalking day, I was supposed to go out to replace the main fuse box on Hubble, and my suit sprung a leak. And that's very bad, because if I go out with water in the suit, the water is going to freeze, expand, and crack, and you know, then all the air goes out, oxygen goes out of my suit, and that's a bad thing. So we had to take my arms off and put them on Jim Newman's suit, actually my suit arms. I left my arms on, and I went out with his backpack, and we did something that was very scary. We unplugged Hubble for the first time in 12 years. Hubble had been on orbit working, and we had to unplug Hubble entirely, so it was getting cold, and it's because there was a failure in this box. And this box was not designed to be changed out on orbit. It had all these connectors that were too close for our gloved hands to fit. Imagine working in the suit, you're the Michelin man. You're inflated, and anytime you want to move your arm, you have to do an integral of FDX work against the suit. And so it's a physical task. So after we got it out, then I had the task of putting all those connectors back on, and that was my Zen task, one connector, you know, just focus. And in the meantime, the Hubble's getting cold, and I was just so thrilled I didn't break the telescope when they turned it back on that I took a picture. Those first 3 days really set the stage for the highest priority, which was the fourth day, to get the new digital camera into the Hubble Space Telescope. And I'll describe how that camera works a little bit, just a view inside to the people who are nice and warm and cozy. And this new camera is just mind-blowing. I mean, it's going to enable a lot of science and discoveries that, you know, we can't even imagine. The instrument we were replacing is the faint object camera. That's what Jim is holding there. That's about 600 pounds. And again, he could go ha-ha, but he didn't. And so it's hard to manage in terms of you want to move it slowly. And that's the last of the original instruments. Now everything has been changed out. There's one instrument that's not being used, the COSTAR. That's the contact lens that we put in Hubble to correct the spherical aberration, and that'll be replaced on the next mission. All the new instruments incorporate that correction into their instrument. So these are about the size of a refrigerator, and just have a few electrical connections, and then we brought the faint object camera home. So we have that advanced camera for surveys, and the other big science objective of this mission was to bring the near-infrared camera multi-object spectrometer back to life. That's the infrared camera. The infrared camera lets you see through dust and is very important for cosmology as well, to see the galaxies which are redshifted, so more redward. It had run out of coolant due to a thermal short. It basically boiled off faster than expected, so it was dormant for about 3 years, 3 or 4 years. And some very clever person designed a mechanical cooling system that we were going to put inside the telescope. However, again, this is something the designers of the telescope never imagined we would be doing, so we had to be a little bit creative. And this is the electronics box for that. So we put two boxes about that size inside the telescope on the floor, clamped down to the handrails that are supposed to be for us to use to do other kinds of work. And we hooked all those up. This mechanical cooler has a little turbine in it, actually three of them, about the size of your pinky, and they turn at 450,000 RPM. And it's a little alternator. And so what we're doing is taking heat out of the NICMOS detector to generate electricity, which we dissipate in a little resistive load. And we dump the heat from that load overboard with a big radiator to deep space. So we're heating up the universe a little bit. That was Jim going back into the airlock waving goodbye. I'm inside the telescope now pretending I'm Edwin Hubble at the prime focus of the 200-inch. But they wouldn't open the aperture for me, so I couldn't really look through. And we're installing the cooling system. As a part of that, you know, I had to be a mechanical engineer or a mechanic, an electrician, hooking everything up and doing all the wiring. And then later on, a plumber. As you'll see, I install this large surfboard, which is the radiator. It's an ammonia system. It's about 3 feet by 12 feet. And again, something that they didn't want me to let go of. So we hung this on handrails on the outside of the telescope. If we ever bring Hubble back, we'll have to dump this overboard. And then there's a conduit that we swing underneath the telescope. And on the bottom of the telescope are some holes that were designed to let air out as the Hubble went up the first time. So we stuck something in that hole, and we pushed all this plumbing through. And then Rick and I had the unenviable task of trying to make it neat and tidy. And that's not just so the Hubble looks good to the other telescopes in orbit. It's because we don't want to introduce jitter inside. If you have a loose cable that's bouncing back and forth, well, then the Hubble will jitter, and it's not worth doing all of this kind of thing. So we closed up the Hubble after 5 spacewalks. We had to put all our tools away. We had hundreds of specialized tools for Hubble, very few of which you can find at Home Depot. And then we had a chance to do what we just did, is stare into the sun for a moment while we make our little speeches, and then head inside. The Hubble Space Telescope is about as, oh, how cold is it?
Oh, tall.
It's the size of a school bus. It's about 45 feet long, and right now it's about 30 feet wide with the solar rays. The next day we woke up early, grabbed the Hubble. As long as Hubble's attached to us, everybody's nervous. Once we get rid of Hubble, then the Hubble people are nervous, but the shuttle guys feel good. And we put it over the payload bay about 12 feet, back to the arm off slowly. And then Scott fired the forward firing jets, and we backed out under the Hubble. And that way we didn't plume the Hubble by going away down. And it went so close over the cabin, and I'd seen this once before, but I watched everybody duck. And instinctively I ducked too. I mean, you can't help it. And then we all grabbed cameras, of course, to be good tourists and take lots of pictures. And part of it's, you know, because of the excitement, and part of it's also we document the condition on the outside of the telescope. Since I'd been there twice, I've actually seen some differences. When I was going on handrails, I go, oh, that little crater wasn't there last time. Something's hit the Hubble. And that happens, of course, all the time. Rick had a laser that we used 435 feet range to the Hubble so we could tell our separation distance. And once we got to a couple of thousand feet, then we could fire the jets again so that we weren't put ourselves in a different orbit. So we wouldn't come back around and hit the Hubble. That's a bad thing to do. Once Hubble was just a star on the horizon, we got to take care of a few things we hadn't had time for. We had a half a day off to do whatever we needed to do. And anything that's not tied down will float away. You got to keep track of your spoon and your toothbrush. That's very important. Exercise on planet Earth is, of course, critically important. In space, it's even more so because you don't get stressed. And so here's Mike. First of all, you can tell he's from New York. He's always talking. And he's getting his exercise. Pardon me? We're in free fall all the time. Actually, the random vibrations are millig. That was Mike. He did a good job. We gave him a nut. This is the Atacama Desert over the South America, coming up on the Andes. I have to say, looking at planet Earth is really the favorite thing for astronauts to do, especially on the short missions, because when you're working, you don't get to do it all that much. And the Earth is, in fact, spherical. You probably already knew that. Maybe not in Kansas or Ohio, but... Did I say that? I'm sorry. Finally, we had to put our spacesuits on and re-enter the atmosphere. And we talked about a time about 15 billion years ago, and this is my recreation of that. We are hitting the atmosphere at Mach 25, and the atmosphere doesn't like it. So it gets ionized, and we're sitting in a fireball at about 2,000 degrees. The mirror is showing what's happening where it all reconnects behind us, and I don't know how hot it is or how far behind us it is, and I'm not sure I want to know. But it all reconnects, and it's very hot. Eventually, we come out of that. This is an infrared view showing the bottom of the shuttle, still very hot as we come over Orlando, and with our sonic boom set off every car alarm in the city of Orlando at 3 in the morning. The landing gear comes down. You can see in the infrared view, that's very cold. That's a good thing. The windows are very cold. That's also a good thing. That's by design of the transonic shocks, that doesn't get hot. Otherwise, they would melt. And we come over considerably faster over the threshold and steeper than a commercial airliner, about 7 times as steep and doing 300 miles an hour. And then we get rid of our energy. And that's because we're a glider. We don't have another opportunity to go around. Now watch the wheels when they hit the runway. So frictional heating is very effective and not desirable, but the tires are rated for it. The pilot helped make the movie, so we get to watch the landing 3 times. They like that landing. I liked the landing also. I'm here to talk about it. And so after traveling about 4.45 million miles, 165 times around planet Earth, doing more spacewalks than any other mission in space history, for a good cause, for the Hubble Space Telescope, we roll to a stop at the Kennedy Space Center. Now, Mr. O'Keefe is the NASA administrator. Notice which hand he shakes. It's my left hand. And he said, I want to shake the hand that did that PCU, that switch box repair. And I was happy to oblige. He's my boss. Now, we also have the tallest astronaut and the shortest astronaut on this flight that have ever flown. And I'll let you figure out which one is which. Okay, so if we can switch back to the slides now.
Well, you got your half day off. Did you quite literally get your half day off?
No, not really. We had no scheduled duties. So what we did is we started to turn our spaceship in orbit back into a reentry vehicle to try and get ahead a little bit. Because we pretty much were working 18 hours a day nonstop up until that point. And so a lot of things just fell through the cracks. I'm very comfortable in the suit, and I'll explain why at the end. And if I don't, please ask that. But it essentially amounts to I've spent so much time in the spacesuit that for me it's now kind of a second skin, and I don't think about the fact that it's difficult to move in or uncomfortable. On the other hand, I'll expound on it just a little bit because it's interesting. 2 months ago, I had to have my shoulder repaired. My rotator cuff was torn. It was torn during the flight. I didn't know it. All I knew is that during the training leading up to the flight in the 2 years, I started having a sore shoulder. Now I'm 43 years old, and I had a flight surgeon that I consulted with, and he said, you're 43 years old, you're spending an enormous time in the gym and 6 million gallon water tank in your spacesuit, you know, your joints are going to get sore. And it didn't stop me from doing anything. And once I got back from the flight in March, I stopped doing all those things, and it didn't get better. And we did an MRI, which is another miracle of physics. And they go, oh, well, this is why it hurts. You know, you have a tear. So, you know, there are some impacts to this. It, you know, now, if I were a football player, I would say I make $4 million a year because I might get injured. Well, I make the same as a postal worker. But don't worry, you're all safe. As I said, this is a very violent event, and I just want to show this picture because this is shortly after solid rocket motor ignition, and the only thing you really know when those motors light, the sequence of events is that you sit in this thing for about 2 hours. You get strapped in, they close the hatch, you do a quick leak check, and then all the smart people go down this. There's seven smart people who are helping you get into the vehicle. They go down the gantry, they get into a car, and they get 3 miles away. And there's nobody within a rather large radius of this 4.5 million pounds of explosive, except for the seven people inside of this little cabin. And then we sit there, and you kind of squirm around, and your back gets sore, and you squirm around some more, and then finally they light the main engines. And they let these three liquid-fueled main engines run for about 5 or 6 seconds while they check out about 20,000 parameters to make sure they're all in line. And then if they're all stable, they light the solid rocket motors. And the solid rocket motors are held down by bolts about this big with explosives in them. And they've done all the calculations to show that only a few of those bolts actually have to frangible bolts have to break in half for the shuttle to take off. And any that don't, it'll just rip it right out of the concrete. We don't know what effect that would have, but basically all you really know is that you're going somewhere when those solid rocket motors light off. And you have to have extreme trust in the person who 40 years ago wrote the code for the computers to control this vehicle and the people at Draper Labs who did the analysis. Because for the first 90 seconds, everything happens so fast in terms of control that the speed of nerve impulses along from your brain to your hand, if you're the pilot, aren't even fast enough that you would have in principle the capability to control the vehicle at this stage. In theory, after 90 seconds, you're out of the Earth's atmosphere already, the aero forces are insignificant. In theory, somebody could, you know, hold it steady and we'd have some options, and we train that way. In practice, I still think there's until about after 2 minutes, it would be impossible. And even then, it's extremely sensitive. And that's just in the simulator. The peak G's that we experience is 3 G's of acceleration. It's all lateral. And that's not for us. That's because at 4 G's, the wings rip off. It's a structural issue. And that would be bad. We went up through that cloud deck, and as I say, you know, I'm looking forward in the windows at launch, and all I see is this bright glow from the xenon lights on the pad. We take off, everything sort of gets pinkish, which is the standard thing. Then it gets a little bit dark. And then all of a sudden I saw the clouds, and it was kind of calming to see these big billowing clouds. But then I had about 3 seconds of integration to see how fast we were accelerating towards the clouds. Normally in an airplane, you know, you plod along and you see the clouds for a long time and then you go poof. But in this case, we were just rocketing literally towards them. And then we did go poof, and then it got black again. And what's neat is all of this light, this is a pre-dawn launch, virtually all of this light, including that illuminating the column of very nasty smoke, is coming from the light generated by our rocket engines. I mean, it's just an amazing experience to be inside or even to see a launch. But what's more amazing is we get to orbit, we open the payload bay doors, and this has happened 4 times to me, fortunately. Nothing's floating out, not bits of pieces of things that are all broken up from being shaken so hard. And these are the solar arrays. There's advanced camera for surveys is in a box here, so we don't really know yet. And the nice thing is NASA has requirements for testing all this stuff in a similar acoustical environment before it goes inside. But just the human experiences, I'm always amazed when I don't see something broken out there. This is the classical view of the Hubble Space Telescope, you know, that we've seen on calendars and on screensavers, that is no more. It's the old solar arrays. They're made out of silicon cells on capton held by springs, and the capton has a gold color. So every 90 minutes we get a sunset and a sunrise, 95 minutes at Hubble's altitude, and it makes these arrays glow beautifully and the whole thing, you know, very gold and dramatic. Well, we replaced these solar arrays with new ones, and I'll show you what it looks like now. It's not nearly as pretty. Of course, you know, we're in free fall all the time around planet Earth. And so that, you know, up and down loses meaning. In fact, I did that experiment on my first mission, and I've done it subsequently just to gather more data, that put myself in the mid-deck, held on to things so that I can zero out my rates, slowly brought my arms in so that I was sitting still in the shuttle, and then I closed my eyes and tried really hard to figure out where the Earth was. Okay? And, it, you know, it's a reasonable experiment. It's a test of the equivalence principle. And, in fact, you know, I would then decide where the Earth was somewhat randomly, and I'd go upstairs and look and, you know, never got it right. I didn't do the experiment enough so that once I could get it right. And, you know, so, you know, all non-accelerating frames, you know, are equivalent. In fact, accelerating frames, too. I mean, we are going around the Earth. But it's just a lot of fun to live in an environment like this. And the human body adapts very quickly. For Jim and myself, on our fourth missions, in fact, basically at main engine cutoff, our brains took a gain matrix that we had stored from previous flights and swapped it with our terrestrial 1G matrix. And for some reason, that's the way the brain works. It remembers things like that. And I guess it's similar to, you know, once you learn how to ride a bicycle, you always know how to ride a bicycle, even if you don't ride one for years. Well, it's true of space flight as well. For Mike, on his first flight, it took him 4 or 5 days before his brain slowly filtered a new matrix. But on his next flight, he'll probably, you know, in the first day, recover that. That means when somebody on their first flight gets to orbit and you ask for a pencil, they do two things wrong. They float the pencil to you, and their body remembers that gravity is going to be pulling it down, so they push it over your head, and they push it at a very high rate because they're also used to having to push with large forces here on planet Earth to move things. And fortunately, they do both of those things, because if they just push the pencil at a high rate, it could be very hazardous. But they usually push it over your head, and then you have to duck, and it bounces around a while, and then you get your pencil. Once they've been in space for a few days, you say, "Can I have that pencil?" And they'll push it directly towards you at a very slow rate, and you reach out and grab it. And that's true if you want to move. Usually it's more manifested of they want to move from one side of the cabin to the other, and they're like a bull in the china shop that they push off really hard. They go flying across the cabin, bouncing into everybody else, and you have to grab them and stop them. And then, but once they've been in space a few days, you know, everybody kind of moves more elegantly, or most people do. And on subsequent flights, you learn how to do that much faster and faster, to the point where, you know, once you've been on a few flights, you get to orbit and you just remember all those things. And I'm using sort of the obvious things. There's other more subtle things. For instance, reading upside down. On my first flight, it took me about 5 or 6 days before I could look at a label on a locker and without thinking about it, read it. And you could practice this on the ground, and maybe that's a good idea, but on subsequent flights, you know, that happened instantly, that I remembered, you know, my brain just started doing that transformation. And that's because you never know what orientation you'll be in when you want to open a locker. So we went out and replaced these solar arrays. Typically, one astronaut will be on the end of the robotic arm in something like a ski binding, and the other astronaut, in this case me, will be free-floating. That gives me the mobility to go and do some of the fine connectors and things like that, while the person on the arm can hold the heavy stuff, the stuff with a high moment of inertia. This is the gyroscope swap. That's Mike and Jim. And this is just a picture to jog my memory that spacewalking is a team effort. We almost always try and team people up. This is still a risky environment. You know, it's a vacuum out here, and inside it's a 4.3 pounds per square inch environment of pure oxygen supplied by our backpack. And, you know, I think it's clear that, you know, if you were to take a glove off or take your helmet off to scratch your nose, that you would die, you know, within a very short period of time, you know, seconds to tens of seconds. So, you know, we kind of protect each other, but it's also a very much larger team. We have 5 people in the shuttle that are working with the people outside with procedures to make sure everybody does everything. There's a radio link to the ground where there's hundreds of people sitting at consoles watching all the details of the shuttle to make sure it's healthy so that something isn't trending in the wrong direction such that they'd want to bring us home. And for the Hubble Space Telescope, there's hundreds of people in a control room, both in Houston during the mission and in Baltimore, Maryland at the Space Telescope Science Institute, making sure that the Hubble Space Telescope is happy as we're repairing it. So when we put one of those big gyroscopes in and plug the connector on, shortly after that, they'll send the command to turn on that gyroscope while we are still there. So in case it's not happy, we can go and tap on it in just the right way. This is the new look of the Hubble Space Telescope at sunset, not nearly as dramatic. These are rigid arrays. They're solid. They're not translucent the way the other ones are. In fact, these arrays are leftover Iridium satellite arrays, surplus, that NASA got at a bargain. And we just adapted those. With these rigid arrays, the amount of jitter in the telescope has been reduced to a factor of 25 from the previous one. So that's significant. This was my hero shot of that box with all those connectors that I trained for so long on. And this is a special handling fixture. When we took a connector off, we'd stick it under one of these rubber bands to hold it out of the way. So when we put the new box in, they didn't get crushed. These suits are really remarkable. They have an oxygen system. They have a backup oxygen system in the backpack. They have a lithium hydroxide canister, which absorbs carbon dioxide. So as we breathe, there's a fan that circulates air around the suit, and the carbon dioxide gets removed, so that doesn't build up. We have a water system that has a sublimator in the backpack that a layer of ice forms on. And the hot water molecules sublime off into space, cooling a block that we run water through. And then that cold water runs through little tubes that are in a suit that we wear inside. And that's how we keep cool. And the reason we have to do that is the suit is a really great insulator. So just body heat would cause, and some of the electronics would cause the temperature in the suit to get really high and uncomfortable. In about 10 minutes, we think, you know, you'd say, "Uncle, I need to get inside." And then your visor would fog up. So we use water to cool it. We have a humidity separator, a little fan that spins and sucks water out of the air so it doesn't get too humid. We have a communication system. We have a little computer. We even have some cameras now on the helmet, and that's how you saw those pictures in the video. And we stole these right out of NASCAR. These are the same cameras that are used in the race cars that show you the... So it's sort of inverse. We spun that off to NASCAR, and then we bought it back. This is that advanced camera for surveys. It's actually got three cameras in it, and I'll describe that a little more. It came up in a box, and again, that's about 800 pounds now worth of instrument. This is that radiator that Jim Newman called my surfboard. He's from San Diego, so he always tries to translate things into surfing terms. And space is really a region of great contrast, and the folks inside were watching me here, and in the sun it's extremely bright, in the shade it's extremely dark, and then of course we're 350 miles above planet Earth, traveling about 5 miles every second over the surface. And the temperature in the nighttime gets down to about minus 200 and about plus 200 in the daytime, and it's that minus 200 that drives the warmth of the suit. That's when you're really happy that you have a suit that insulates really well. And then finally, we had to look straight into the sun for a picture. And we gave a little speech when we were done. And it was, you know, just like being outside. So both of our eyes look like they're closed, because they probably are. And someone asked me, what do I enjoy more, floating in space, you know, flying around like Superman inside, or looking at planet Earth? And I think that was in Kansas that somebody asked me that, as a matter of fact. And I had to think about it for a little bit. I'd never really tried to decide, you know, which do I like more. One of those psychological type exam questions. And then after a while it came to me that after about 4 or 5 days or 3 days, you kind of start taking the floating for granted. It's just a fact of life. Your body's adapted for the most part. But I never get tired of looking at planet Earth, and so clearly that's the most fun and interesting thing to do. And that relates back to, you know, what we may do in the future as far as traveling to other planets. When you're between here and Mars, you know, there won't be a whole lot to look at. And that's when I plan to solve all the problems in Jackson. Okay, so this is the first quiz I learned from Lawrence this morning. What hemisphere is this in? Very good. This is southern hemisphere. It's a cyclone. It's somewhere in the South Pacific. And you see a lot of this. This is about 100 kilometers across. And it's just really neat to be able to see, you know, all the kind of phenomena from this view. This is a picture actually that we gave to President Bush in April. And we picked this picture because we knew he was thinking about this area. And there's a lot of reasons why I think this is an interesting picture. You know, one of which is this is geologically, you know, extremely active area on Earth. I mean, there's two rifts here, two cracks in the Earth. Seafloor is spreading that way and that way. It's pushing up mountains here. It's spreading that way and that way. It's making this mountain range here. And you can, you know, see pretty clear evidence of some kind of faulting activity here. And this rift runs all the way through Africa and is responsible for the large chain of volcanoes and the lakes, Lake Victoria. There's also a lot of activity going on here, and for whatever reason, this area, basically as far as we have recorded history, for some reason has been a region of conflict. Now maybe that's true about everywhere people live, I'm not sure, but certainly this region of the earth. Now my commander, who is a very staunch Republican, a Navy commander, commander of the United States Navy, presented this picture to our president, and of course the president is his commander-in-chief. He's my boss, but it's his, as a military person, it's his, my commander's commander-in-chief, and handed it to him and said, I know this will be interesting to you. And then for some reason he got poetic. You know, and this is a guy whose job was to, fight the Russians, the Soviets. He probably carried nuclear weapons on his airplane, who knows. I mean, definitely a highly trained military person. And he said to Mr. Bush, he said, "And what always strikes me is how thin and fragile the atmosphere looks." And the rest of it, I mean, all of our jaws dropped, Just, Mr. Bush has one side of, the fence of on the environment. That's the other side from where I sit. And so it's just very interesting to see his reaction. Let me move on before I get in big trouble. This is your one geography lesson for the day. If you see something that looks like a seahorse and has volcanoes on it, that's the Galapagos Islands. And there's two reasons I put this picture in here. For four flights, I wanted to see the Galapagos. I'd rather see it on the planet, but this may, at least in the meantime, this is as close as I could get. Kind of an expensive way to see it, I suppose. But Charles Darwin, sailing along on the Beagle, discovered a great deal about a particular subject that we've discussed, and in fact, the fact of evolution had already been established by this time. People had a record of evolution occurring in the geologic history, and what he developed was a very interesting theory of natural selection by seeing the diverse biodiversity in these islands, and I think that's a crucial point in the earlier discussion. And in fact, he was wrong. Because it's not a steady net. It's also clear from the fossil record that it's not a steady process of natural selection, that it's some kind of punctuated, the theory is that it's a punctuated natural selection in response to some kind of stress, which reminds me to say that, one of the neat things about kids, I have little kids, is that they're for some reason, and this has been true, for almost a century, they're very interested in two things, space and dinosaurs. And space and dinosaurs are integrally connected in the event of about 65 million years ago in the Yucatan, where probably the Earth's climate was altered significantly and was responsible for us being here and them, the dinosaurs, not. This is Florida from space, from about 350 miles, and we're always very interested in looking at Florida near the end of the flight when this picture was taken, because we launched right there and our intended landing site is right about there. So we like to do some weather forecasting. They send us the weather on a little fax, but we always like to do our own. So this is the Hubble Space Telescope after the repairs, and what we did to the Hubble Space Telescope was improve its discovery capability by about a factor of 10 or more. And that's equivalent to taking your 5-inch reflecting telescope that you might have and going out and buying a 16-inch telescope. Well, a 16-inch telescope. So it's quite a remarkable improvement. And if someone were to, at the ITP were to say, "I want to go test my particular string theory model of cosmology," and they were to go to Congress and say, "We'd like you to build a new telescope that's 10 times more powerful than Hubble," somebody might say, "Well, what will it cost?" They would probably have to say, "Well, maybe $10 billion with the capability of Hubble in $2002," and that would be the end of the discussion, because nobody would do that. But we were able, on one shuttle mission, with people going up and servicing that telescope, to make that kind of improvement. So again, here's the crew. This is the quiz time. Okay, which one's the tallest? And actually, you can't really tell because Rick's in the foreground, but Scott Altman is the maximum height for an astronaut, and when he's in space, he's actually too tall to be an astronaut. And it's kind of like that twins paradox, in special relativity. And Nancy, we don't know if she's actually tall enough to be an astronaut, but she is. She's one of our senior astronauts. But when she's in space, she is definitely legal. And that's because when we sit here on planet Earth, gravity pulls us down towards the surface, course, we push back most of the time, and our spine gets compressed. And when you go to space, that pressure is off, and your spine expands. And so for the 45 days, I've been taller than my father, who's about an inch and a half taller than I am. No comment. Okay, so that's the space adventure part. Let me tell you a little bit about the camera and what's coming out of it. The advanced camera for survey is nothing more than a super-duper digital camera. It's got three instruments or detectors in it, three cameras, one of which is a wide-field detector. It looks at a relatively big picture, and that's comparable to the one that took the picture, that deep-field picture I showed you, but it has about twice the area. There's a high-resolution counter. It's good for the zoom pictures, and it's the first camera that actually takes advantage of the superb optics of the Hubble Space Telescope. Its pixels are small enough that it can sample the beam as well as the telescope optics can accommodate. And the other one is a solar blind camera that has the capability to be a coronagraph. And basically, a coronagraph is a way of looking at objects that are very bright where you don't want to see the bright object. So for instance, if I wanted to look at the audience over here, which I can't see because of that bright light, if I put my hand in front of the light, okay, now my eyes have adjusted and I can see all of you. So if I want to look, say, for a disk around a star where planets might be forming, I would put a little obscuring disk in front of that star, and then with Hubble, because it's above the atmosphere, the scattering is very low and the instruments are very sensitive, I might be able to image that disk, and that's precisely what this is for. And it has other uses as well. This is a picture of the really big CCD in the Advanced Camera for Surveys. It's about that big. Basically state-of-the-art technology. And the big deal is it's also got some really good coatings. So it's about twice as big, and when a photon of light comes in from the telescope, bounces on some mirrors, this is the mirror that corrects for that spherical aberration and goes into the detector. For the wide-field planetary camera, the one that took that deep field, at best, only about 1 in 10 photons that hit the detector are actually recorded as a voltage, which we measure. For this new wide-field camera, it's more like every other photon. So that's about a factor of 5. So when you take a factor of 2 in area, factor of 5 in sensitivity, that's sort of your discovery potential. But it's even more important in another way. This is a picture of a globular cluster. It's millions of stars. We think that they may be stars that form very early in the evolution of our galaxy. They're sort of self-contained, and I'm interested in them because they have lots of pulsars in them. But this picture was taken with the wide-field planetary camera too. This is sort of a before and after situation. And this is that high-resolution camera. Now, hopefully, you're very under-impressed at this point. You go all that effort, you risked your life for this. And there's some details. You know, one detail is if you look at a given star like this one, and you look at that star, you go, yeah, that's a little better resolved. It's a little bit smaller. Stars are point-like still. We can't resolve, you know, an actual disk. There should be points, but the detectors and the telescopes smear them out. So you can tell that the resolution is better. But the reason why this is really so amazing is that this took 14,360 seconds of observing to get, and this was 660. And so that means you can just explore more of space. This took a lot less time, so you can see a lot more of space. And we have explored a very small portion of our universe with all of the telescopes on planet Earth and in space combined. So there's still a lot of things to discover. Okay, I'll probably have to play that animation again, but this is a couple of galaxies called the MICE. Okay, astronomers like to name things for public release that have good names. And so these are their bodies, they have tails. These two galaxies are colliding with each other. It's mostly a tidal interaction. Stars aren't actually hitting stars, but these two are doing a kind of cosmic dance around each other. And because of that tidal disruption, material is getting thrown off at high velocity out of those galaxies. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's a cool picture. And two, this is what's going to happen to us. We are getting closer and closer to Andromeda every second. And it's a good thing that we don't have skylights in here because it would be very scary. And in about 2 to 3 billion years, we'll look kind of like this with Andromeda. So you don't have to rush out of the room or anything like that. But it would be a very interesting time to be alive because it's hard to see Andromeda now. It's very faint. You have to go to Hawaii or somewhere interesting, you know, not down in a mine. Nope. Oh. Where's Dan? There he is. And Andromeda will loom huge in the night sky as it comes into collision. Now, the Earth will probably still be here. The Sun's not going to swallow us up for a few billion years after that. Now, just to give you an idea of what's happening, you've already seen this, but this is a simulation with only about a million stars. These two galaxies come in, they start interacting with each other. This is a tuned simulation, so the results are expected to look very similar, but it's an accurate simulation. What's really interesting is what happens afterwards. The two galaxy cores converge. There's probably massive black holes in each of these, another Hubble result that almost every galaxy has a massive black hole. And in the end, you end up with an elliptical galaxy with highly evolved stars, and it's one of the mysteries of astronomy. How do we end up with what we thought were early-type galaxies without a lot of spiral shape, but that have evolved stars? The other thing that these collisions do are, because of the tidal interactions and shocks, they generate new stars. So these are very hot young stars of tens to hundreds of solar mass, and they're going to burn really fast and burn out just in millions of years. And so your challenge is to try and identify in your high school students those hot young stars and encourage them to not burn out really quick, but to do slow and steady progress. But there's a lot of associations in here that we can start to learn about galaxy evolution, because these collisions are probably very frequent. But what's really neat about these pictures, and maybe we can bring that light down a little bit for the rest of the Hubble pictures, is just the level of detail that this new advanced camera for surveys provides. You play with the brightness and contrast a little, and you can bring out all sorts of really beautiful things in these galaxies, and you start to get more of a feel for the 3D nature. And I'm not going to talk about what's in the background quite yet. These are, hundreds of millions of light years away. So these are actually close in the big scheme of things. This is actually three images with three filters that are combined. Every Hubble image is black and white. It's taken through a filter. And so this is approximately, well, this one I've mucked with. So this is not what you would see with your eyeballs. The previous one is close to actual colors. This galaxy is called the Tadpole Galaxy. It's not quite as obvious, but you might guess from the previous slide that this is also the result of a collision. And in fact, there's a very small dwarf galaxy that probably came in like this and has disrupted, it's sitting right there now, disrupted this beautiful spiral into ejecting this large plume of gas. And stars are forming in these clumps of gas. And eventually, this stream will disappear but leave behind these little dwarf galaxies, which will then go off and do more damage to other nice spiral galaxies. So you can see these clusters, about a million stars in each, and this is the offending dwarf galaxy. As an example, this is a star in our own galaxy, a foreground star, and so you can tell because it has this diffraction pattern due to the support structure in the secondary mirror on Hubble. And so again, this is that picture without any annotation on it. And now I want to talk about the background, because this is my new favorite picture. I'm going to tell you what's interesting, but not as interesting. This is a foreground star in our galaxy. This is a foreground star in our galaxy. That's a foreground star in our galaxy. That's a foreground star in our galaxy. And if you see any others, you can help me, but I think that's it. Everything else in this picture is another galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars at varying distances. Again, this is about the size of your fingernail held at arm's distance up on the sky, this picture. And pardon me? Any quasars? There's probably quasars in here. Quasars, we're more likely going to see in the radio emission. But if you compare the number of galaxies in this picture to the Hubble Deep Field, there are about twice as many galaxies in this picture. That Hubble Deep Field had about 1,500 galaxies. If you say that you count the light in a little area to a certain significance, at the same significance, this has about 3,000 galaxies where that had 1,500. And so I think about Polynesian, I guess we lost our Hawaiian counterparts, but the Polynesians have a cosmology. Everybody has their own cosmology, and of course they're all right. But the Polynesians, one version of cosmology is that the Earth sits on a giant turtle, and that's how it makes its way around the universe. And well, you have to ask, being a good physicist, well, what does that turtle sit on? And the answer is another turtle, maybe a bigger turtle. And well, what does that turtle sit on? And you know, it starts to get a little bit annoying after a while, and another turtle. And finally, the Polynesian gets annoyed, and he says, look, it's turtles all the way. And so my interpretation is, you know, so far, you know, it's galaxies all the way, at least in optical. And for the very first time with this instrument and some further images, we are starting to be able to look at the morphology, the shapes of the galaxies, as they are very, very distant. And so if we look for some of the really red galaxies that are faint, you know, if we pick one here, and the work has started to determine the redshifts of these galaxies, how fast are they receding, and from Hubble's law we can then determine the distance, and some of these are at redshifts of 3 and 4, we're getting quite far back in some cases 13 billion years, and the galaxies are starting to look funny on average. We see very few well-organized galaxies, and so we're thinking we're starting to get to the point at almost 14 billion years where galaxies started forming. And that's a bit of a surprise. That means they formed really fast. Stars and galaxies organized themselves very, very soon after the Big Bang. And so there's a lot of work to be done in this, and they're also, of course, just beautiful pictures. In my days as a graduate student, if somebody took a picture of this galaxy, or took this picture, you know, they would see this galaxy and they would start doing spectroscopic studies, and this would become a PhD thesis. And if this picture had been available then, there would probably be a dozen PhD theses in this one picture alone. So the bottom line is that the Advanced Camera for Survey is reaching the Hubble Deep Field depths in 1/12th the time. So that, again, that means we can look at more of the universe now. And even Hubble won't be able to map the entire sky at this depth, twice as many galaxies as the Hubble Deep Field. This is zooming into one little corner of that picture. It also means that if you want to put it as a screensaver, you know, you can zoom in quite far on these new images before they start to look fuzzy. Coming back into our galaxy, you know, one of the other mysteries of astronomy, and of course we're only talking about a few percent of the universe, the normal stuff that we see. This is called the Cone Nebula. It's because, you know, if you look at the big picture, you see this cone shape in the picture. That's a ground-based picture. This is the Advanced Camera for Survey picture. And what we're seeing here is really remarkable. There's some bright stars up here that are heating gas. There's gas all through here, and they're heating it and causing it to glow. And what we're seeing is carbon and oxygen, ionized carbon and oxygen, and magnesium and iron glowing. And in this area, there's a very high density of material, so high that it blocks the light, and we're seeing the shadow. So that's why you don't see the gas in here glowing. And in this very, very dense pocket of plasma, stars are being born. This is a stellar nursery. And it's one of the mysteries of astronomy still. We don't understand something as basic as how the gas comes together and eventually nuclear ignition turns on. So this is a stellar nursery, and hopefully we'll be able to study these images and learn more about it. And one of the tools that we now have that we didn't have before is here, zooming in on some of those bright stars near the tip of the cone with the Advanced Camera for Survey in visible light. And here's the NICMOS picture. And in the infrared, you can see through the dust. It's just because it's the longer wavelength. And lo and behold, things start appearing. And we don't know yet whether they're inside or just background stars. That's work to be done. But we've kind of seen through the veil into the nursery. So we're hoping that this is new leverage. The same can be true on galactic scale. This is a view of an edge-on view of a galaxy, a spiral galaxy. The reason it's dark here again is there's a lot of dust and stuff that was left over when the galaxy was made. It's kind of like when you build a house, there's a big pile of lumber left over and somebody carts it away for you. Well, all that lumber is still in the galaxy. There's nobody to cart it away over reasonable time scales. When we go to infrared, we can start to peer through that. And if we filter it even further and just look for a particular line in the hydrogen spectrum, you know, we see that there's this really active region near the center of the galaxy of star formation going on. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting stuff, a new tool. So that's really the main part of my talk. I have a few other comments. So this is sort of my catch-all that I wanted to go through. First of all, the big message, as I said earlier, is, you know, science is a lot of fun. And, you know, I can't tell you how exciting this business is, and being able to enable the Hubble science and to be able to be a space adventurer. And it didn't come for me from wanting to fly airplanes, you know, and launch off of aircraft carriers. It came because I love astronomy and I wanted to do science. And science, Dan said it this morning, science is fun. And that's the bottom line. And that's why we do it. We have a curiosity and we're driven to understand how the universe works. And it's just, and that in itself is remarkable that we are able to and do spend time trying to understand how the universe works. The other thing is, being a cosmic ray physicist, I got to have a little extra fun in space. And the cosmic rays that Dan was talking about, and somebody asked about, from who I asked about putting the experiment in space, and one of the things that we get to do is to be cosmic ray detectors. And so one evening, when we were passing through the South Atlantic Anomaly, I happened to wake up, and by evening, I mean I had eye shades on. By going around the Earth every 95 minutes, we get sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset. So you only have 45 minutes of daylight and then 45 minutes of darkness on average. It's actually a little more skewed because of our inclination in orbit. But so when we sleep, we put in earplugs, because everybody snores, and eye shades. And so my eyes were dark adapted after about 4 hours of sleeping, and I opened them. And to my surprise, there was a huge light show going on. And it's the South Atlantic Anomaly is a region of trapped radiation where a lot of singly ionized particles live. And so as we went through there and my eyes were sensitive, I was seeing light being generated, and again, measuring a voltage. My retina, the light is generated in my eyeball from these little cosmic rays going through, depositing energy. The light travels through my eye, hits the retina, generates a voltage, which my brain then records and interprets as some little flash. And I saw just a kind of a sea of all these little teeny flashes. And it was really remarkable. I knew instantly what it was as a physicist. And there's nothing I could do about it, so I thought I might as well enjoy it. And after a few minutes, I discovered that there's different levels of these things, that most of it is a little sea, and that's all the protons and singly ionized particles, just one charge unit going through my eyeball. And I much rather there'd be a bigger flash. And thinking about the cosmic ray composition, I sort of ascertained that those are probably carbons and nitrogen and oxygens, cosmic rays, galactic cosmic rays. So these poor cosmic rays have spent about 10 million years spiraling around magnetic field lines in the universe until finally they made it through the solar system to end up going zipping through my eyeball. And I think that's kind of interesting as a physicist. And then every once in a while I'd see a much brighter flash, and either it was a very heavy element like iron, or it was something traversing straight through the retina. And so those are some of the problems of doing experimental physics, where you're not in a very controlled situation, you know. And you know, Dan has to deal with that all the time, even down underground in a mine. And it's a very challenging work to understand your background. The only other thing that I wanted to say is related to the time that we live in. Is again, 4 years ago, if you had a cosmologist sitting up here, he would tell you a very nice story about the history of the universe. And he would tell you that we understand pretty well how the universe was formed, and that there's a period of very rapid inflation, and that after that rapid inflation, the universe was expanding slowly, and we can explain the composition of the elements, and we can explain the expansion, and we know basically what the universe looks like and the matter content. And yeah, there is this problem with you know, the missing matter, and we're working on it, and that accounts for the rest of it, and we're working on understanding the geometry of the universe, but those are details. Everything else is pretty well established. And the particle physicists and the quantum theorists would tell you, we understand the basic families. There's a lot of searching to do for the details, but the basic model is there, and then there's the string theorists. And there's just that one problem of uniting the three forces with gravitation, but it's a very hard problem, and that's being worked. And I think, you know, it's just incredibly exciting that just a few years later we now say, well, everything we knew prior to now is basically in the details, but we don't have any big picture. And I think that's very exciting. And to echo what Lawrence said this morning, I have actually experienced this effect of whatever you want to call it, dark energy, because after spending 10 days in orbit and you come down to planet Earth, you climb down the little stairs and you try and stand like this, you'll notice especially that Mike Massimino has his feet rather widely spaced. There is no question that gravity does suck. So with that, I will close. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was great. I think we do have time for questions, so I don't know whether people can shout them or what.
Yeah. If you have to replace the lens because of the aberration, Do you have to recalibrate everything again? You know, all the other...
That's a good question. Actually, the big picture on Hubble is that it was launched in 1990, and it got to orbit, and the pictures were blurry, and there was a slightly more than brief moment of panic by all the participants until they got to the actual drawings and realized that the mirror was the wrong shape, but it was otherwise a perfect mirror, and that the shape was extremely well understood. And as a result, it was very simple conceptually of how to fix it. Basically, put a contact lens in, and that would recover everything. In fact, now that all of the instruments incorporate that contact lens, the performance of the telescope actually exceeds the design requirements. That's pretty amazing. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, you know, we're yanking instruments out and putting them in and closing the doors and coming home, and for 2 weeks they don't turn anything on because we pollute the telescope. We outgas. And you know, that's why I'm standing up here and all of you are standing there. No. Even though we bake out the suits and take great care to make it extraordinarily clean, we don't have radioactive dust floating around or not much of it, they still wait until all the stuff from the shuttle, we do water dumps to get rid of excess water and all sorts of things, before they start anything. Then they start it. So if one of the instruments is out of alignment, unless they were to accommodate that in the design, you know, you'd have to wait a couple of years for somebody to come and tweak it. So they build into the telescopes that some of these mirrors can articulate and move up and down to focus. That being said, the telescope is so stable that generally we put the instruments in, lock them down, and of the 1,000 or so steps that they can move, they usually only have to tweak it one or two steps to get the perfect focus. They understand it that well now. Okay. In a space suit or in the space shuttle in general? Yeah. I mean, you know, the wonderful thing about doing experiments is that you know, you develop the theorists come up with a theory, or you develop a theory and you go and test it, and you're fat, dumb, and happy, you know, doing the experiment over and over again to accumulate better statistics, and then somebody, you know, proves that, you know, there's outliers. And so you've just proven there's an outlier, because that's the second question that people have asked in this group. And usually, the potty question in a group of medium age about this is much, much later. And the reason I say that is my personal experience and theory has been that when you talk to kids that are elementary school age, especially first, second, and third grade, and that's one of the first questions they ask. By the time you get to fifth grade, kids are afraid to ask that question, and they don't ask it at all again, usually until they're young adults. And then it's very late in the talk, in the questions, until you start talking to the retired folks, and then again, it becomes the first question. So I'm afraid to say that I'm calling you sort of an outlier data point, but I'll still answer the question. And when you're in the space suit, first of all, before you get in the space suit, you want to make sure that you use the facilities. Because on my first flight, I spent over 11 hours on the first spacewalk inside of the space suit, eight and three quarters hours outside. To accommodate that, I wear a diaper. And, you know, unfortunately, the atmosphere in the suit is very dry, and you lose more water than you carry in the little canteen inside. So I actually haven't ended up using the diaper, just because you end up getting dehydrated, and that's not a very good thing in space. But inside of the space shuttle, we have what looks like an RV potty, and it has, I have a slide of it, but not a physical slide, but not a computer slide, and it has a little tube, and inside of a box there's something that's like a little jet engine. And you start it up, everybody wakes up on the space shuttle if it's the middle of the night, because it's so noisy. That's why the earplugs as well. But each crew member has their own funnel, color-coded funnel. There's boy funnels and girl funnels. You put that in, and you pee into the tube that sucks the air in, and that gets stored in a water tank, in a waste tank. And then periodically, we dump that overboard. We don't dump it when we're docked to the Hubble, however. Sunlight hits it, breaks up the molecules, and they go back to their constituents, the same, you know, constituents that stars provided us to make us. So so that's a very environmentally friendly way of getting rid of it. The solid waste, however, goes into a holding tank. And the way that works is there's a seat. It looks like a normal seat, kind of. Except if you imagine trying to sit on a normal seat in space and do your business, you would float off. So we have these little handles and little restraints that hold you down. And the seat is slightly raised, so airflow goes into this tank. There's a little slider that you open up, do your business. We have wipes. We even have wet wipes with the little teddy bears on it. It's because, you know, you want to clean up really well in this case because you don't want something floating around that you might ingest or inhale. That would be very bad. Pneumonia in space would be very bad. So you clean everything up, you close the little guillotine-like hatch that is in this tank, and you push a button and it vents it to a vacuum and freeze-dries all the poop. And then we keep that and we bring it back to Earth. And you know, I'd hate for some other spacecraft if we dumped it overboard to... You know, that is. Especially because crossing orbits, you know, it could have 25,000 kilometers per hour closure. That could do a lot of damage. So we bring all of that back to planet Earth.
Barring any catastrophes and money problems, what is the anticipated lifetime?
Hubble, there's no reason that Hubble couldn't last almost indefinitely. And you think about the 200-inch telescope on Mount Palomar, it's still doing cutting-edge science. Even though we have 8-meter Keck's in Hawaii and other big telescopes around the world. So it really just comes down to a money question. Now, that being said, if we don't have a space shuttle go up to the Hubble every 2.5-3 years to replace some of the moving components that do wear out, eventually, you know, we won't be able to operate the spacecraft anymore. Because it doesn't have thrusters as well, when it comes into the atmosphere eventually, 4 or 5 years, its orbit will decay due to the little bit of air that's up there. It'll slow it down. And it'll come in uncontrolled. And that mirror is so thick that it would survive to the ground. And so we don't want to do that. So we have to do something with Hubble. We either have to bring it back, which would be very difficult, or send it into a much higher orbit where, you know, it'll be thousands of years before it comes down, and let our, you know, great-great-grandchildren worry about it. Or go up there and put some kind of a control thruster system on it, small, so that at true end of life, we can aim it towards the Earth properly and give it a burial at sea. And it all comes down to funding. And again, it's like other issues we've talked about. The people, folks who are happy and think Hubble's doing great science are very unlikely to write Congress and say, don't let Hubble die. You know, but if people feel that way, they need to, because otherwise there's no funding for continued Hubble operations beyond about 2007. And we don't get the next generation space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, until probably 2012. 2010 is scheduled launch, so I'm hedging a little. So there's a gap there with no space telescopes, and that's not a good thing. Hubble is extremely productive. In fact, I would say if you look at the history of telescopes, you know, people's eyeballs were first, and we learned a lot. Then came the telescope that Galileo used, and we learned, you know, a tremendous amount. Our knowledge expanded dramatically, orders of magnitude. Then we had the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson. And suddenly we find out, another Copernican revolution, that we live in a universe filled with galaxies and that the universe is expanding. And I think the next jump has been the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's kind of an exponential in the number of things that we've discovered or learned. And in fact, I think that's the greatest thing about the Hubble right now. The stuff that we've seen is wonderful with Hubble over the last decade, over the last 12 years. But I'm absolutely convinced that the greatest discovery that Hubble will make has, you know, that is just on the horizon with this new capability, because we have seen so little of the universe. And hopefully it'll help to answer, you know, some of the questions that have been posed earlier today.
Thank you very much. I think that's a good way to answer questions. Thank you. Thank you. That was great. I guess it's up to me to, in fact, thank everyone. And there's a bunch of people I want to thank, I suppose. I don't know if David wants to say anything, but I want to thank the staff of the ITP who, you know, come here on the weekend and have really put this together. And and also made my life so easy. And on behalf of the speakers, I want to thank all of you for the incredibly interesting questions and great interest. And I know that... it's been an inspiring day for us as well. So thank you very much.
Okay.